Thanks for tuning in to the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center's podcast. In this recording, join Vitaly Golem, Managing Director and Global Head of Investments at IEG, when he goes over how to beat Silicon Valley by investing your time where VCs are investing their money. Now, here's Vitaly.
All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about beating Silicon Valley. I'm sure everybody recognizes where this is from, right? So a lot of times I do this talk outside of the country, and it's good to do it actually here in the center of the universe. So real quick, let's go back to that. So let's dive right in. So IEG, I was previously at HP, corporate venture arm of HP called HP Tech Ventures. HP is a little company that started in 1939. Silicon Valley's original startup, $53 billion revenue. And for the last couple of years, before joining IEG earlier this year, helped build a corporate venture arm there and invest in startups and funds as well. So now I've joined IEG. IEG is a 19-year-old investment bank. Investment banks are a little bit different. Investment banks help startups raise money and help startups sell themselves or large companies buy startups. We also are setting up a number of our own funds as well. We're about 100 people in 7 countries, and I run the new San Francisco office with my partner, Giovanni Soletti, here. So that's a little bit about IEG, and I won't tell you much more about that unless you ask me. So to dive right in, we are really in the middle of the third industrial revolution. It's a very interesting time to be alive. What we saw from late 60s to early 2000s was an exciting time, but what we're in the midst of now will be a 50-fold change in the next decade or two. And the interesting thing is that first industrial revolution was about 80 years. The second one was about 65 years, cut short by World War I. This one is happening in the course of about one generation, about 20, 30 years. And what that means is that we're going to see a lot of economic stresses because entire workforces are going to be redone, right? First and second industrial revolution, we had the son doing something quite different than the father, and then the grandson doing something the grandfather couldn't imagine. Well, this is happening in the next decade or two, and we're right in the midst of it. You can start basically at the birth of the mobile era of the first smartphone, real smartphone, iPhone, in 2007. That's really when all of this really kicked off with mobile internet and pervasiveness everywhere. And really, this is about bridging or merging physical and digital worlds, right? This is what describes this particular industrial revolution that we're in the middle of now. So exciting time to be alive, and that's really the context that I want to paint for the rest of what you're going to see here. And the nice thing is, as Colin mentioned, I started out pretty young. My parents happened to move us from Odessa, Ukraine, from Soviet Union when I was 8 years old, spent a few months in San Francisco, and then grew up in Cupertino. Went to the same high school as Steve Jobs and Wozniak. So for me, it was all natural and native and normal to be running around the startup office at the age of 13. That's not really normal other places. By the time 99, 2000 rolled around and I was a freshman in college, I was running a team inside of a well-funded enterprise software company, enterprise software startup. And it cost us $5 million just to get online, right? Getting servers, getting database licenses, racking them up, getting everything set up, and then typing hello world. That was $5 million. Obviously, don't have to do that now. And obviously, we have the infrastructure in place now that we have to thank the dot-com days for that allows us to start a company anywhere in the world much, much easier. All you need is an idea, right? Now, if we look at the world, right, and I travel to a lot of countries and have a very global perspective, and I try to kind of bridge the world to Silicon Valley and bring some of that Silicon Valley mindset to the world, you take a look and see, kind of try to predict where's the next wave going to come from. And if you look at where the top universities for science, engineering, really the disciplines of the future, right, this is computer science, chemistry, engineering, material science, physics, space science, etc., U.S. is still number one as far as number of colleges that are considered best in the world. But we have a really stupid immigration policy, as we know, which is getting dumber by the day, where we educate the world's best and brightest, and then we send them home, right? So big negative for us here, and big positive, I guess, for everybody else. We're trying to even out the world that way. Now, here's the effect. If you take a look at things like the HackerRank, which rank the best software developers in the world, U.S. is not even in the top 20, right, as far as competitions. If you look at algorithms, artificial intelligence, U.S. is not even in the top 5. In either category, right? So you can look this up. This is the HackerRank. Just put it in the Googles, and you'll see. So really, it's about combining great companies, great technologies that can be born anywhere today with what Silicon Valley is really good at, which is high growth very quickly, right? This is the Silicon Valley model. You're not building a lemonade stand or a lifestyle business. You are trying to build an enterprise in 5 years. All right, that's really what we're doing here. Now, let's talk about entrepreneurs. All right, so entrepreneurship path is quite different. If I really feel like I didn't really have a choice, I kind of fell into it, and I never really went the corporate route. The only time I've ever spent time at a large company was my 2 years at HP recently. But before that, it was my own company's entrepreneurial approach to all of it and doing it myself. Now, this is at my mom's chagrin. She always wanted me to have the safe thing. And the traditional path, you know, this normal escalator, this normal career in the U.S. is, you know, you get good grades, you get into a good college, you get into a good company, you're a good boy or girl, you get regular promotions, you stay there, you turn around and go, wow, where did the last 10 or 20 years go by? Then you retire, play golf, and die, right? So that's a normal career that your parents want you to have. Not to mention the fact that the average person, you know, the average time on a resume now, at least in Silicon Valley, is under 2 years, right? So this dream is long gone, but let's pretend it still exists. If you look at a startup career, everybody reads, TechCrunch will write about you twice. When you launch your company and you get a round of funding, and when you sell the company or go public, or you have some big disaster that's newsworthy, right? Right, it goes one way or the other. And everybody thinks that startup career looks like this. It's just a straight path, overnight success. Reality is that these are overnight successes, 10 years in the making, a lot of pain, a lot of personal pain, you know, that has started coming out in the last few years. People are starting talking about it, but they're not killing it all the time. They're not in a great mood. They're putting on a fake smile. They're trying to motivate their teams, but they are miserable inside. Right? It's a very, very difficult journey. So this is my favorite quote from Ben Horowitz as a startup CEO. I slept like a baby. I woke up every 2 hours and cried. So this is very much true. You know, running companies, my own companies for 15 or 16 years, you tend to build up crocodile skin and start getting used to it. And you're going to hear a lot more no's than yeses, and it can't really faze you. But it's really difficult, especially on first-time entrepreneurs, right? It's a shock to the system. Now, it takes a while as well to build a company. And if you really start thinking about your own personal career and your own time investment, it takes about a year to develop an idea, right? You've got this idea, you're doing some research, you're talking to people, socializing it, seeing if it's something worth doing. You're finishing out whatever you were doing before, you want to quit your job, whatever it is. It takes about a year, if you're honest with yourself. It takes another year or so to see if anybody cares, to find the next customer, right, your first customer, or to really validate it and see if there's a product there, to really understand how people are solving this problem now out there in the big, mean world, go to a few conferences, and fully sink in. Now, it takes 5 to 8 years to see it through completion. That's the reality. That's what you're signing up for. And if you're the founder and CEO, you can't really walk away from it, especially if you have employees, if you have investors. You are in it. You are in prison. You've got yourself a sentence, and you're going to do it whether you like it or not. You might not like it. So if you take a look and you start right out of college, reality is the first startup, you might go for a couple of years and it just doesn't work out for some reason, one way or another. So you say, okay, I need to go learn a little bit. I'll go work at a large company, get some more experience. And I like to say that your first startup should not be your own. You should go and get some experience in a fast-growing company. That's the only way to get that kind of experience. Or you might go to business school and you'll get a little bit smarter. So usually that will mean that you will fail your next one faster. All right, so I didn't make up the rules. So the next one after that, odds are you might be onto something and you might spend a few more years working on it. You might have a small exit. You might have a big exit if you're lucky. You might get pissed off and break up with your co-founders and walk away with no equity and, you know, just hard lessons, right? In the same mattress on the floor in your one-bedroom apartment that you started with, right? But in reality, you look at it, wow, 10 years just went by and you're in your early 30s. Your next one's going to take you into your mid-30s, right? And at some point, you have to listen to your mother and go get a job, right? So the point here is that it takes a long time, and you can't keep doing this forever. You have to, you know, I'm looking, most of the audience is pretty young, like early 20s, so with a few exceptions. And this is really what you're probably thinking about right now is, what is it that you're going to do? When you get that interview question where you see yourself in 5 or 10 years, this is what you're thinking about right now, right? So you really have to be careful about where you invest your non-refundable lifetime when you work on a startup, right? So ultimately, if you're Game of Thrones fans, this is you. And my goal is to help you to increase your chances of survival, not necessarily success, right? It's how you define it. And to do that, we're going to talk about how, where, and what to work on, right? This is very important to kind of start really breaking this down and thinking it through. Now, first part, how. A startup, it's very important to understand and to define what a startup is. A startup is much closer to the scientific method of trial and error than it is to building a business, right? The reality is that you're working on something net new, right? There's no manual to this particular thing that you're doing. That's really the point. If you can figure this out, you can build a lot of value quickly. If somebody's already figured out how to do this, then you're not going to have that leverage. You're not going to be able to build something really valuable. It's not unique. It's already out there, right? So you're doing experiments and you're doing them as quickly as possible to get to the point where it starts looking like a business, right? It has profit. I know it's a bad word. P is a bad word. You know, profit is a bad word in San Francisco. We care about scale. So, you know, and it's generally done in three stages, right? And it's really important to understand that a startup is not a smaller version of a large company. For a long time, you're in the woods. You don't really understand what is it that you're working on. You can't build structure around something you don't understand. You're building experiments, right? So this is really the scalable startup phase, right? And if you're not familiar with Steve Blank, he's been kind of quiet for the last couple of years. I highly recommend you look him up. But essentially what you're trying to do in this stage to graduate out of it is find the product market fit and understand your business model. Who's your customer? What problem you're solving for them? Start getting some evidence that you're actually solving a problem for them. They're willing to use the product, pay you for the product. And then you start understanding what businesses that you're in, right? The next stage is a transition. This is where you're scaling very quickly. This is where you go from 20 to 150 people, right? This is when you're maybe break even, maybe profitable, right? This is when you're scaling very quickly and you're really building that business. This is the most exciting part of this whole process. It's very exciting. This is where things break. This is when things are created. And this is the part that you really need to experience at another company before you dive in. So you taste it in your mouth and you know what it's supposed to feel like when it's working. Now, when you go through this phase and you've built a management team with people with some gray hair that understand the industry and have been around, you know, you're a really world-class company in this particular sector, congratulations, you graduate and actually become a company. So the whole goal of the startup journey is to go from left to right as quickly as possible, spending the least amount of money as possible, because the less money you raise and need to build your company, the more of the company you're going to hang on to, right? So if nothing else, that should be your selfish reason to do it as quickly as possible. Time is money that you're burning. Right? And if you think about it, you know, a lot of companies around San Francisco that are just huge companies with thousands of employees that would have been public at any other time before SoftBank came in and started writing multi-billion dollar checks, these are not startups anymore. They call themselves startups. Uber's not a startup. Airbnb is not a startup. These are enterprises. These are private enterprises. And they've graduated through this a long time ago, right? They're just waiting for the right time to go public and cash out. So very important to keep in mind. Now, really important concept, you know, pardon me if I get a little academic for a second. So Clayton Christensen made this very famous, this technology S-curve. Clayton Christensen, Harvard Business School professor, a legend. And there's a really important element here, and this is a really important framework for you to understand, is that with every technology, for a long time, there's a lot of money and time that goes into research and building this technology to a point where you can then commercialize it and turn it into products, right? Whether these are products that open up new possibilities that weren't possible before, or they disrupt and do something 10 times better, faster, or cheaper than was done before, that is really the short window, and this is the innovation sweet spot. So essentially with every S-curve, you have 2 to 5 years, maybe a little more, to go from a startup with a few people, an idea, and a little seed money, all the way to a public company and enterprise, and own that particular new market. All right, so this is where VCs invest. So I'll tell you a little secret. This is why VCs go from theme to theme, from hashtag to hashtag, because we're chasing these different waves, right? Because this is where value is created. This is where you go, you can build a great company, you know, that's just profitable and it's growing slowly, organically, and it doesn't need money from investors, but it's usually going to be kind of a smaller scale, slower growing kind of business. It's not a place where you're going to put in $1 million and get $1 billion out of it 5 years later. Or, you know, in most cases, you lose all of it, or most of it, but you have this opportunity to build a big enterprise. So that's really what VCs are looking for, right? Is for companies that can ride that wave, get the timing right, they're not too early, they're not too late, the technology is ready for the market to build products, and it's the right team that can really capitalize it, that understands the problem, and can really build a great company out of it. So if we change this graph just a little bit, we get to another really important concept, which is staged financing. And this is really unique to startups. The concept of stage financing is not something you'll find in traditional businesses. And it really goes like this. So for a while, you're burning money, right? You're really, really negative. Then you start becoming a little bit more, you start becoming profitable, break even, and you start making money. So if you overlay this ladder of raising capital, you have a concept, you raise seed, right? Concept and a good team, you raise seed. You have some early validation where you have some initial customers, they're willing to pay you money. You can then probably raise a Series A. You get more validation and you really see this thing working, you raise Series B, and on and on and on for a while until you get to really predictable scale where you're dominant in a particular market, and then you IPO on NASDAQ. So, in most cases. So this is textbook. It never works this way. It's never this clean. There's a lot of down rounds that nobody talks about, where there's two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, three steps back, what have you. But this is really what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to really scale up the company. Interesting side note is when we're talking about ICOs, everybody's familiar with blockchain and ICOs, I'm assuming. What's happening that if you look at it this way, it's really seed stage companies raising Series D rounds, right, with a lot of money. But here's something that's a little scary for investors is that at every stage, there are about 3,500 companies that raise seed capital from professional investors in Bay Area every year. Maybe about 10 or 20% of those, depending on the year, graduate to Series A, right? And it's sometimes an order of magnitude more money. With each round, you're getting an order of magnitude more money, but you're drastically reducing the risk. If you have seed stage risk and you're raising $100 million, then God bless you. You're going to be in a lot of pain at some point. Statistically speaking, a lot of pain. So if you look at Silicon Valley over the years, you can see these S-curves laid on top of each other. Right? So we've been doing this here for 70 years, just about. I highly encourage you to look up again Steve Blank's Secret History of Silicon Valley on YouTube. You can also read about it in my book, that plug. And it's really important for you to understand kind of how all of this happened and how this special place in the world has generated the most value of any place ever in the history of civilization, how it was born and what powered it, right? Starts with Stanford, starts with World War II, Defense Department being the first customer of Microwave Valley before Silicon Valley, and a lot of really interesting things. But if you look at this, you know, it's a question of all these things laid on top of each other. Clean tech, nanotech hasn't really taken off. Some of these are misfires. But we have integrated circuits without which personal computers wouldn't have been possible 20 years later, without which internet would have been possible 20 years after that, et cetera, right? So you can see how this progresses. And as it happens, most of these companies, these great industry titans, are right here. So this is the magic in Silicon Valley. Now, where, right? So, you know, obviously we're in the center of the universe as far as we're concerned for this industry. But other parts of the world are starting to catch up a little bit. It's really, if you regularly go to these ecosystems, you'll see them progressing. They're nowhere near, obviously, where Silicon Valley is because we have this complete ecosystem and generations upon generations of experience. And out of the population in Bay Area, about 7.5 million people, something like a quarter work directly in tech. Right? You don't have that anywhere else in the world, right? Let alone the experience. And I'll come back to that in a second. Now, U.S. also, you know, Silicon Valley is a magical place, and it looks like no place else in this country except maybe New York. But there are lots of other great hubs of innovation and industry hubs around the country for a lot of really interesting historical reasons. So I really encourage you to kind of read up on it and look at other parts of the country where a lot of the different industries are, because what you might be working on, what you studied, what you might specialize in might be well placed there. And you might be going there in the next 5 or 10 years and doing a disruption there, right, for a particular industry. And this brings me to this really important concept of innovation clusters, right? So each one of these cities, Silicon Valley certainly being the biggest one, they're comprised of different players. And it's really important to understand the different roles that we have in play here. Right? We certainly have entrepreneurs and VCs, right? So you guys probably think that's the most important thing. Everything else doesn't really matter. But in reality, corporates are really, really important drivers of all this. A big part of why Silicon Valley companies are so valuable is because there's so many big companies that can buy them if they falter. And there are, I don't know, 100 times more companies that get bought than go IPO. So there are also strategic investors. Almost 30% of venture capital actually comes from large companies. There are about 1,000 corporate VCs worldwide, and they either invest directly into companies or they invest into funds, right, in a lot of cases, that then invest in companies. And there are also huge R&D centers where a lot of this technology gets cooked for many years, and then those engineers might take off with that technology, or they come out of university research, right? University is the next bubble, and they go on to build these great companies, right? And universities have to build, they have to graduate great engineers, great technologists that are on the cutting edge. If somebody is sitting in a large company for many, many years, odds are they're a little bit behind the times. But it's really important to get fresh engineers out of university because they're really on the cutting edge of technology. So most of that innovation comes out of university. And also, obviously, business education is a big factor. If you look at, for example, Eastern Europe, where I spend a lot of time and work with a lot of startups, sales and marketing skills are really absent, right? This experience is not there. This institutional knowledge of how to sell things is not there. And that's a really big factor. On the other hand, you know, if you have a lot of MBAs in the company, MBAs are taught to divide the world into four quadrants and really think of it this way in this really specific framework. When you're working on something new, that thinking in that framework might actually be a disadvantage to you, right? You do need that beginner's mind to be able to crack some of these new puzzles and be open to these new models, right? Now, the other part of it is management. So this really is the secret of Silicon Valley, is that we have about 50,000 director-level managers in Bay Area at any given point that have gone from zero to hero with the company, right? You don't have that anywhere else. This is why companies from all over the world, if they have good traction and they want to scale and they have a global story, global idea, they will come here because as they're trying to scale and outrace everybody, they need that connective tissue, experienced managers that can make this thing work, and you're trying to build an organization out, right? So this is really our secret. It's not the money. It's this. It's really the management experience. And then you need professionals. You need lawyers and accountants that understand how to deal with venture-funded companies. I can tell you lots of cases where lawyers that don't understand technology and how these companies work that have killed deals, that have killed companies, or have cost a lot of money because they're learning on the job. Government has a very important role. Now, in the U.S., you know, this is a mature market. Silicon Valley is a mature market. It's not really that big of a deal. But back in the 70s, the U.S. government was, 60s, was the only customer or the first customer of Microwave Valley. And then they started investing and doing 2-to-1 matching funds for investors to encourage New York East Coast investors to come out west and invest in these highly risky technology companies because they wanted that technology to live. And venture capital is short for adventure capital because it was so risky. True story. So government has a really important role, and a lot of governments are really starting to understand this, so they're doing these matching programs. You look at Estonia, Singapore, Israel. Israel was probably the first one in the early 90s to do this, to do matching funds and encourage investment in technology. And you can see this effect. It works. There needs to be kind of a kickstart. And then you have governments that try to get a little heavy-handed, or they really don't support the sector, and they go after traditional industries. So really, you have to try to encourage them. So I see lots of diversity in the room. If you actually have connections to another part of the world, you should export. Part of your role, part of your job is to export this mindset to anybody that will listen back home so you can encourage them and help them mature their ecosystem. All of this lives in large pools of private capital, and the interesting thing is that you have angel investors and a lot of private money that goes into venture funds or goes into the first series of investments in these companies, and people really invest in things they know and love and understand, typically. So here, it's, you know, a lot of successful entrepreneurs that have built their own companies, right, from technology. If you look at New York, you have people from the advertising industry, from the financial industry, so you see that there's a lot more investment in those type of startups. Same thing in LA, you look at entertainment industry is much more pervasive, so you have a lot of entertainment industry investment, so they'll invest in their own things. So it's a little bit of circle that you see happening. A lot of private capital will kind of steer towards things that they understand, where the region is naturally good at, right? What the industry is good at. And then finally, all of this lives in a place where you need to be able to at least have the ability to take the company public and make that money, those shares in that company, turn that into cash again, right? So you have to have this objective of public stock market. So that's why companies in Europe will usually, well, startups that have global aspirations from anywhere, Europe, Asia, et cetera, they will form a Delaware Corp because they have the opportunity to go to have liquidity in US, right? Or London Stock Market, London Stock Exchange, LSE is another one, obviously, that a lot of UK companies will go for. If you look at the economic impact of venture capital, it's quite profound. So over 40% of companies that are public now, that have gone public since 1979, were venture funded at one point. And they are actually a lot more efficient, right? They're almost 50% more efficient than the average company because they are, the market cap is 57%. The 42% of the companies with 50% of the market cap of all the public markets. And they're much more efficient. They have fewer employees than the average company. But the most important number is that they are responsible for over 80% of the R&D dollars that go back into the next generation of technology. Right? Nobody's going to beat Facebook because Facebook will be the next Facebook. Right? And Google will be the next Google. And Apple will be the next Apple. Right? because these companies are investing in R&D and nobody can catch them, which is a different discussion about, you know, before there were a lot more opportunities where you can disrupt these big players, but now the large companies are the internet companies who are very, very smart, and it's very difficult to disrupt them. Now, this is the fun part, what to work on. So let this number sink in real quick. 75% of the world's largest 500 companies, according to Boston Consulting Group, in 10 years have not been started yet. So think about that. The opportunity is huge. And BCG, all the other consultants, their product is selling consulting and selling really interesting stats. But this is reality, is that there's going to be continuous huge disruption. The amount of time it takes to go public has stretched a little bit, but companies are growing faster, larger, and this is going to continue, and you're going to see a lot of companies fall and a lot of companies rise. So this is really, again, interesting time, you know, a lot of opportunity. It may seem that everything's already been invented, but far from it. All right, so let's talk about real quick a few different areas that I see a lot of opportunity in. And these are areas that I track. So healthcare and food, finance, economics, transportation, logistics, also known as mobility now, and manufacturing. Right? These are huge, huge categories that are ripe for disruption and are already being disrupted. So this is where it gets fun, and you'll probably want to download the slides with the link at the end, but CB Insights is a great resource, and there are a number of companies already that are being worked on that have the opportunity to change the world. And not just, you know, build these massive monster companies, but really change the way we live, the way we learn, the way we stay healthy, and all those things, right? So newer technology, regenerative medicine, autonomous construction, intelligent public safety, synthetic agriculture, rockets, on and on and on. A lot of really interesting categories that are categories of the near future, where companies are already being worked on, right? They're well-financed. And if you look at artificial intelligence, this is a big, big factor. We're doing a little pre-interview live on Facebook. And for me, this is one of the areas that obviously is really important to pay attention to, because AI will go into every single category. And we're already seeing it in every single category of companies. News media, IoT, healthcare, automotive, agriculture, financial services, AI, automation is coming into absolutely every single industry out there. Right, so this is a huge factor, and this is really the next wave. Now, if we look at another buzzword, VR, AR. So VR kind of didn't really take off, and I'm not really surprised. I've been tracking it for the last few years. VR is really a bridging technology. It's more about consumption of content, right? You kind of sit back, or it's entertainment, you play games. It's compelling, it's cool, but for most people, it didn't really go mainstream because it's cool for 20 minutes, and then they're kind of done with it. AR is actually a lot more interesting, augmented reality, because it will change the way we compute. Right, so we won't have phones in our pockets, we won't have laptops anymore, we won't have these shared experience like a big screen. In a few years, everybody has their own way of perceiving the world, and you have this mix of digital and physical. Right, you're going to have a much richer, much more interesting experience. And you can already see the technology stack being built out. Right, so we have a lot of the components, the input and output devices. We have full devices being built on top of that. Right now, mobile phones are really the number one thing that's being tested. On top of that, we have tools for creating content, creating interactivity, and then we're already starting to see some of the first generation applications out there. All right, so AR is going to be fascinating. Can't wait for Apple to put out their eyeglasses, whenever that'll be. Don't think it's going to be this year, but it will be happening. If you take a look at some of the companies they acquired 5, 6 or more years ago, you'll see where they're headed. And transportation is really another interesting category. You see lots of autonomous cars being tested around San Francisco. But in reality, it's not just about you have a car that drives itself and you don't have to turn the steering wheel. The effect is much more profound. If you look at, obviously, our cars are stagnant for 95% of the time. So you already see this effect. In cities like San Francisco, you shouldn't really own a car. It's actually, in a lot of cases, just cheaper to Uber everywhere. But this is going to change again, where you're going to see autonomous cars that will change the economics of all this. Apply that to commercial, to logistics, to transportation, and the effect is much more profound. Right, so most popular profession in the United States is retail clerk. By the way, AI is going to hurt that as well. Then we have about almost 5 million professional drivers in the country and about 5 million professionals that kind of live off of that category. So the diners, the gas stations, the mechanics, etc. Right? So 10 million people. This country employs about 160 million, 170 million people in total. So imagine 10 million of those people losing their jobs right away. It's going to feel a lot worse than 2008, 2009, a lot worse. And the problem is that at the same time, we need a lot of software developers, but you're not going to take a truck driver with maybe a GED on average and turn them into a software developer overnight. They just don't have the skills. So this is, you remember when I started talking about the pain with the next industrial revolution, this is really it. The other part of it is that with autonomous trucks, for example, the economics change. Right? Under 500 miles in the U.S., it's trucked. Over 500 miles is rail, right? But a lot of it is because you have drivers and they can only drive so many hours a day, etc. As soon as you have autonomous trucks where you don't have a driver, they can go 24/7, they're much more efficient, and their EVs in a few years, the economics is going to change. And that's going to take $11 billion in market cap away from the rail companies as well. So they're now investing in this category, just like BP and Shell and Chevron are investing in electric vehicle infrastructure, even though they're oil and gas companies. All right, so you're seeing a lot of this change, and this is really interesting and fascinating. Oh, by the way, insurance is going. The concept of insurance is going to change as well. Auto insurance, if you don't own cars, right? And if you're borrowing cars or it's an autonomous car, how do you insure an autonomous car or an autonomous commercial vehicle, etc.? Now, you can tell that this is really a big deal because the slow, boring, stupid car companies have really started to invest, partner, and acquire startups starting about beginning of 2016. And just about every single major car manufacturer has an R&D office in Silicon Valley. Right? They are not going to be left behind. And there's two themes. Electrification, all cars will be electric at some point, probably sooner than we expect, and autonomy, big, big factor. Now, as I mentioned, transforming finance. So there are a number of different categories. It's not just the blue-collar jobs where it's a repetitive task going from left to right or what have you. We're talking about professionals in finance world that are being disrupted already. Probably more profound than anything is the financial industry right now as far as financial services and a lot of different other things that are being disrupted by automation and algorithmic type of work. Healthcare is another really interesting area. Healthcare, as we know, is a big pain in our United States ass. $3.5 trillion market. With digitization of the healthcare chain, we're seeing two things. First of all, we're trying to reduce costs, and if we can automate certain things, we can do that. We're also trying to improve outcomes. Obviously, the point of the healthcare industry is to cure people, hopefully, right? Sometimes we lose sight of that. But in reality, we're going to see a lot of advances in healthcare, thank you to AI in a lot of cases. Because of FDA, a lot of this is actually happening outside of the country as well. So a lot of companies, you'll see healthcare companies, they get a little bit bigger, stronger outside of the country, and then they'll come into the U.S. with a product that's ready to go through FDA, which can take, depending on what they're working on, anywhere from a year to 6 years to get to market. Now, this is a really interesting area that I've started looking at more recently, which is synthetic food, right? Synthetic meat production. This is something that's coming down the line. This is not too shocking for people who live in San Francisco, but when I bring this up, people get a little bit scared in other parts of the world because this is new. So if we take a look at what cattle production means for our environment, if cattle country was a country, it would be the third biggest polluter after US and China. This is pretty bad, right? And our population is obviously just growing. So demand is going to go up. It's almost going to double in our lifetimes. It's a third of all water that's used for animal. A third of all water is used for animal production. A third of all water is used for animal production. It's crazy, right? So if we look at kind of the value chain and how meat is produced right now versus the near future that we're going towards, right now you have barn breeding, you have feedlot, slaughter, processing, and then goes into distribution. Instead, we're going to have live tissue sampling, and then we're going to be culturing those cells and multiplying them into real meat without the animal, right? So this is actually pretty interesting. And if we look at, you know, where we're at right now, you know, for a pound of beef, right, for 1 pound of beef, we use 1,800 gallons of water. We use 260 square feet of land. And the alternative would be to go to the synthetic meat. So in the near future, we're talking about drastic reductions in amount of water, amount of land, amount of greenhouse emissions that are being produced. And the only barrier right now is it costs about $12 per pound to produce synthetic meat versus $1 a pound for natural meat. That's going to change quickly. If we know anything about these technology S-curves, right, this is going to change very quickly in a few years. So this is something really to look forward to. And if you happen to have a bio background, bio degree, this is a great place to work, right, to work on your startup. Now, if we look at, it takes about, as I mentioned, about 8 or 10 years for a company to go public, right? So that means that investors have to think about 10 years ahead of the public markets, VCs. And that means that we're kind of the tip of the spear. And if we look at the trends, investment in artificial intelligence, we had a huge jump last year, a huge jump. I thought it was going to be kind of incremental and we'd get to, I don't know, 6 billion maybe, but we got to almost 14 billion in 825 deals in AI. Maybe a lot of it is hype, but we're seeing a lot of push into that across a lot of different industries. So it's a very interesting place to track. Now, this is from Chris Dixon. You know, this is really important, and to, again, kind of coming back to this S-curve concept. For a while, technology has a gestation period, and we saw that with the PC era in the 70s, then it went mainstream. We saw that with the internet era in the late 80s, early 90s, it was kind of all the geeks, and then it went mainstream. Saw the same thing with mobile era. Mobile era, we can argue, is for the most part somewhat over in this current form. There are 2.5 million apps in the App Store. For you to think of something wildly different than just get in the App Store and become the next Instagram, it's just not going to happen today, right? It's going to be a grind of user acquisition and spending money on advertising and trying to become unit profitable and all those things. So what's next, right? And Steve Jobs' favorite quote was from Wayne Gretzky, Canadian hockey player. Canada, we love you. And they asked him at some point, some interview, they asked him, you know, how are you so good? Why? How are you always there? How do you know where to be? Well, you know, I'm not going to where this was. I'm going to where the puck is going to be. And that's really what you need to think about is kind of you're launching your rocket, and it's going to take you a couple of years for that rocket to gain altitude. Where's the market going to be at that point so you can intercept? All right, it's just a little rocket science. And depending on where you are in the world, I'm assuming many of you maybe came from other places, different parts of the world, came here specifically because you want to be in the Startup Olympics. But if you happen to have a global perspective and you want to look at other opportunities, you have to think about how different parts of the world are going to be developing. So US will continue to grow. Europe will continue to grow a little bit slower. There are different focus areas that are being looked at in different areas. But in China, you know, in greater China, Asia will continue growing fastest of all because population size. But I want to point your attention actually to Africa. Africa does not get enough mention, enough attention at all in Silicon Valley or anywhere. Like, you see people from just about anywhere in Europe, anywhere in Asia, going to conferences, a lot of this cross-pollination, but there's really not enough connection with Africa. The opportunity in Africa is that you can actually, when you have no infrastructure, you can actually start implementing the latest generation, right? We've been trying to build this high-speed rail in San Francisco to LA, for over a decade. I have news for you, it's not gonna happen. I don't know if this is a shock, but it's not going to happen. And the reason for that is it's just too expensive to replace the current infrastructure. When you're talking about a place that is up and coming, they're going to implement the latest infrastructure. You can look at Southeast Asia, what happened in Southeast Asia in the last 20 years. You look at the megacities in Southeast Asia, amazing. And the same thing is going to happen in Africa in the next couple of decades. So amazing opportunity, leapfrog technologies. If you want to talk about digital currencies, that's actually the best use case there, not stable US dollar, which, you know, if US dollar is not stable, then cryptocurrencies are going to be the least of your worries. Now, back at HP, we're looking at kind of four very specific areas, kind of different lens: hypermobility, Internet of All Things, smart machines, and 3D transformation. And together, that's really this kind of the blended reality between physical and digital worlds, right, coming together. And if you look at, you know, hypermobility today, you know, we take these things for granted, but we have high-speed internet in our pocket, we have devices with sensors on our wrists, etc. We can walk around in VR. We had first generation AR, you know, Google Glass a few years ago. Again, a little too early. Remember the S-curve. And question is, what's going to be hypermobility tomorrow? Well, hypermobility tomorrow will be nanobots, will be little swimming computers in your bloodstream. Sounds a little scary now, but there are companies already working on this, and this is the future of medicine. This will be a much bigger change than germ theory was a little over 100 years ago, right? We're talking about, you know, you're not going to be popping pills. It's going to sound completely Stone Age in our lifetimes. If you look at IoT, it became kind of a bad word, a buzzword, and what we know as IoT right now is these like little $100, $200 Bluetooth devices that talk to our phone and do something, Kickstarter, that we kind of throw away. In reality, IoT is about internet enabling, capturing data out of everything and doing something with it. So putting intelligence at the edge, right, into these little sensors that can enhance our life at some point, that's really what IoT is going to be all about in the coming years, right? So if you remember the letter E, for those of you young enough, remember the letter E 20 years ago that was being glued onto everything. E-commerce was one of the only ones that survived. It's kind of a no-brainer that, you know, doing something online is the way to go. It's the most efficient way. So IoT, think of it the same way. It's really about collecting data, doing something with that data. Maybe in the future, all these chairs will be internet-enabled, and we'll be able to know from the sensors in the chair, you know, maybe first generation will be occupation sensors, which will control the air conditioning, make sure it's perfect for every part of the room. But maybe later on, that sensor will be able to recognize you and be able to post something online for you or be able to track for your personal logging how many minutes you sat in the chair here or there or anywhere, right? So think of these things and how this will change the way we consume products and use different things. And certainly security is a factor here, so a lot of opportunities in this area. Smart machines. So first generation of robotics is really about hydraulic muscles. Next generation of robotics is about hydraulic brains. So we're no longer talking about doing physical labor, doing something repetitive or physically difficult. We're talking about making decisions, a machine that can make decisions. And if we look at a few different examples, so this is Breakout, classic video game, one of the first, and DeepMind, Googlebot DeepMind. So researchers there basically decided, let's see if we can build a machine learning algorithm to test, to let the algorithm teach itself how to play. So all it gave the algorithm is the objective of beating the game. So the rules are you need to use this brick, use this ball to break up everything, and that's how you win the game. So at first, the game was playing, you know, the algorithm was playing the game quite poorly. It would hit the ball, it would miss the ball, and then within a few moves, it started to really understand, okay, the cause and effect, and where should I hit? And then within something like 240 moves, something like that, it learned how to hit exactly right to beat the game in one move, far beyond what a human can do, and rather quickly. So that's all fun and games, literally, but what do we care? You know, why is this a valuable experiment? Well, if you start applying the same thing to things we care about, like biological puzzles, we can start applying the same practice. So for 100 years, scientists could not figure out the biological model of a tapeworm, where if you cut it in half, it'll regenerate itself. Obviously, something that's quite interesting for medicine, could have some use cases. Well, they put together an algorithm, I think it was DeepMind as well. 42 hours, they cracked this biological model by trial and error very rapidly. So we're now far beyond what humans can do, period. Right? They couldn't do it for 100 years, this algorithm did it in 42 hours. Obviously, this is the way to go. And if we look at kind of beyond that, you know, we start packaging that into products. This is Pepper, 2015. This was the first robot, humanoid robot, that can recognize and show emotions. It's a little bit crude, it's first generation, but it sold 1,000 units in under a minute, right? It was released in Japan. Japan is no accident. In Japan, we have quite an aging population where companion robots are going to be a very important product in the near future in that country, right? And ultimately, if you saw Bicentennial Man, and Hollywood is a really good predictor of the future. I recommend watching Robin Williams' Bicentennial Man. You know, these companion robots will actually be something that hopefully will sooner rather than later. And this is the first generation. And why is that important? Well, this is actually quite difficult, right? This is programming emotions. When you have an industrial robot that's just doing something as efficiently as possible, moving an object or doing something or screwing a bolt, assembling a car, that's quite easy, but to program the overhead of emotion to be able to interact with a human, that's very, very difficult, right? So think about that. So that's kind of the next level there, where a robot can make a decision based on something that's not quite simple, based on the interaction that they have with somebody. Now, the last area is 3D printing, and this is really interesting. So 3D printing is one of the horsemen of the next industrial revolution, and really will change manufacturing. So before the Industrial Revolution, everything was handmade and time-sensitive. I can't impress upon you how much of a big deal that is, that everything was handmade by craftsmen. Now, with the Industrial Revolution, we got ourselves blueprint design and mass production. We also got our education system that we have today based on that in the US, based on the world going into this kind of manufacturing, organized labor type of thing. The internet gave us computer-aided design and just-in-time machine production, right? It made it a lot easier. We can send designs across, etc. And we are somewhere over here right now. Now, next is we're talking about 3D printing, commercial 3D printing, not little MakerBot making an iPhone case, but getting into manufacturing, having a completely digital chain. So you design a physical object, you hit print, and you get a physical object. That's a profound change. And what we'll see beyond that is being able to use AI in combination with that, where you give the AI in some form, you give it a task, a challenge, and it will create a physical object that solves that challenge. So this is Skynet. So Skynet is a combination of artificial intelligence and 3D printing. Right, as soon as we connect the two, we're screwed. So I'm going to show you a quick video. So let me give you a preface here. So all of this is based on the concept of a voxel, which is a volumetric pixel. Right, and you can go voxel by voxel. Right now, it's 20 microns. It's about the resolution. You want it smaller. And you can go pixel by pixel, voxel by voxel, and control the translucency, the transparency, the physical properties of each grain, of each physical pixel the electric conductivity, et cetera, right? All these elements, right? That are the building blocks. And how efficiently you do this, how quickly you do this, this is how you build physical products. Basically, 3D transformation today is very crude replacement for plastic injection molding. Now, where we're headed is being able to print complete electromechanical devices, print complete bio devices, print food, print vitamins, right? You can take a blood test with your Apple Watch 7 without touching your blood and be able to print yourself some vitamins that you need, right, to ingest, right, on the spot, for example. We already see companies that can print circuit boards, that could print very crude integrated circuits, print batteries, 3D print batteries. So we're starting to see the building blocks. So it's happening. So don't mind the little infomercial, but quite proud of HP for building this out, because this is really HP 4.0. HP started, first customer of HP back in the early 40s, late 30s, was Walt Disney with an audio oscillator. And it was a instruments company for a long time. Then it got into the calculator business, then the computer business, then the printing business, a bunch of other businesses. And now this is really HP 4.0, is getting into industrial manufacturing with 3D printing. So this is a big deal. It's still quite early, but you can already, depending on, you know, with these type of printers and other companies, you can actually do serial manufacturing, small batch, you know, a few thousand, and it's cheaper than doing injection molding. Now, soon you're going to start seeing metal products, ceramic products. You're going to start seeing a lot of different materials and a lot of electromechanical devices starting to come online. So what does that mean in the near future is that U.S. will become the number one manufacturer in the world again. And instead of packages on a ship coming over, there'll be raw material coming over. And perhaps one day you'll have something in your kitchen the size of a dishwasher. And next to your electricity, gas, and water, you'll have magic fairy dust coming into your house. Order something on Amazon and print it out, right? This will happen soon. This will happen in the near future. So with that, I'll give you a little bonus. So let's talk about blockchain real quick. So you have 3 different types of data structures, right? Centralized, decentralized, and distributed. Centralized is you have one data source. You have a lot of clients connecting to it. Old model, very easy to understand. Decentralized, you have a few different copies of this data, and they can all talk to each other, different hubs and different masters. And then distributed is that every hub is a master. Everybody has a copy of all the information. Okay, great. So that's the basics. What does all that mean? Here's a traditional model, client server database. It's a master copy. The new model is that there are multiple, you know, you can talk to any single node and it has all the information. And they have to agree, and that's how you can trust them. So what that means is that we have this digital trust concept, right? What does that mean practically for us is that certainly you can verify identity, because 10,000 nodes said that that's this person's identity or this object's identity, right? And they all agreed, and it's very difficult to modify them all at the same time. It can be a notary where it confirms a certain transaction that happened, right, between different parties. It could be digital assets or securities, we're NASDAQ, don't tell them, but there might be different exchanges that trade different goods that are sold in slightly different structure, right? They're digital shares. And it could be different asset classes. It could be the future of timeshares. It could be done on the blockchain where you own a piece of that timeshare and it's recorded in a much more efficient way than in the way they do it now, for example. Smart contracts. So smart contracts, there's a lot of hype around smart contracts where this will replace lawyers and these complex things could be executed. Reality is right now, these are simple booleans. These are simple if-then statements at this point, right? You can't execute something super complicated in smart contracts. Right now, it's a very theoretical concept. Digital voting, certainly a factor. Not in this country, because we can't get anything done, right? It doesn't seem like, as far as the political world goes. But in countries like Estonia, where you have e-government and a very small population, and it's not controversial to tell citizens that we're going to be doing digital voting, what have you, this might be the path to do it. And this is how nobody owns that voting system. Nobody can hack that voting system. It's trusted. And perhaps one day it'll be the standard worldwide. Distributed storage is also an interesting factor. I'm not sure if it's such a strong, compelling one, where the pitch is, well, it's not going to be Dropbox or Box or Google Drive or Microsoft OneDrive. We don't trust them for some reason. That it's going to be distributed and all your information is going to be different places and nobody's going to own it and nobody can take you down. So that's the argument for digital storage, distributed storage. And then there are a whole lot of bullshit use cases. So that's what's flying around San Francisco right now. And most of the money, blockchain-related startups are raising most money via ICOs in Asia, right? There's very little money in the U.S. Big reason for that is regulation. As an investment banker, I can tell you all about it after the fact, if you're interested. So, interesting thing is we're already starting to see this whole industry start to build out. And like I said, many of these companies, most of these companies will not survive, right? This is really first generation, first wave. It's kind of D-Day. They're all going to die on the rocks. And maybe 1% of them will survive. And then the next generation of companies will walk in their footsteps and build potentially valuable companies. But it's going to take some time. There's a lot of hype. It's going to take longer than everybody expects. You're not going to be boiling oceans in 6 months or 3 years, changing whole industries. It's going to take time. So with that, you know, this used to be inspirational. Now it's a little bit ironic. My message to you is that, you know, first of all, think about your path, your career, what you're trying to do personally for yourself, where you're going to invest your non-refundable lifetime, right? Think about if you're going to go the startup route, really be calculating. Don't just do it on a whim. You're getting married to your co-founders. You're getting married to your investors. You're in it for the long haul. You better be happy. Otherwise, you're going to be miserable. Even if you're making money, if you hate what you're doing, it's not worth it, right? Do something else. Life's too short. So with that, thank you very much.